you can start working on the answer to that question while before class starts. You have a calculator, go ahead and use it. You're allowed to cheat. Okay, so I shouldn't have to say this, but I'll say it again. Your quiz is next class, first 30 minutes. I'll be sending out an email right after this class with the seating chart so that you know which room to go to. 260 is the other room. So you'll be at, it's 10:30 to 11, there'll be class after. So don't leave after the quiz, okay? Come to class, okay? So there'll be class from 11:05 to 11:50. So we'll come back and pick it up. But wait for that email; it'll give you the details. I'm going to put up the review session that I have online as well right after class today, in case you want to watch the review. It is a review, so you know when you watch it, right? After you've looked at the material. Review sessions before you look at the material are not as useful as review sessions after you've looked at the material. So my suggestion is at least look at the material, read whatever you have to, then watch the review session, work through as many practice quizzes, past quizzes. There are no practice quizzes. These are all real quizzes as you can, and show up on Monday morning. If you're going to miss the quiz, though, you need to let me know before 10:30. 10:29, 10:28 is all okay. 10:32 is not okay. Okay. I know... Once in a while, you get stuck on the subway. You have no cell service. I understand. If that happens, I'll show me the MTA schedule that you got stuck on to something. And I'm okay with it. But no, I'm going to let... So today, we're going to talk about cash flows. We're going to go from earnings to cash flows. And we're also going to talk about growth rates. And growth rates are a strange thing. We talk in percentage terms, right? 15%, 20%, 25%. And you work with spreadsheets. You start to get casual about growth. Let me try 10. Let me try 15. Let me try 20. We've all heard the lectures about compounding, right? Let's see whether intuitively we understand how much compounding matters. So let's take this example. You have LinkedIn. Let's say the revenues are $200 million. Small, potentially high growth company. Let's say I put in a 30% growth rate in revenues compounded every year for the next 10 years. I'll let you use your calculator on this one. So the answer should be almost exactly right. What are your revenues in the 10th year? Anybody? What do you get as your revenue? 2.7 billion? Is that what you got? I got 2.7. How do you get to the revenues? You take 200 times 1.3 raised to the power 10, right? I got about 2.7, roughly 3 billion. So round it up. It's a trick. You're saying, why did you, you'd have thought I'd have picked the highest number to show. No, for the moment, it's 3 billion. Let me now try a little experiment. Let's assume that I made the growth rate instead of 30%. I've doubled the growth rate. Remember, it was about 3 billion with a 30% growth rate? If I double the growth rate, what do you think will happen to revenues? Don't use your calculator in this one. Try to see if your gut gives you the right answer. It's 22 billion. 22 billion. Remember that when you sit there with a spreadsheet saying, what's the big deal? I just made 5 into 10%. Doubling the growth rate looks trivial, and the number that's going to tell you that you're walking into dangerous territory is not your revenue growth rate or the revenues in year one. Check your revenues in year 10. That's always the first thing I check. When I do a valuation, I check my revenues in year 10. Why? Because I want to make sure that my valuation is not in fantasy land. What's fantasy land? If I put in $22 billion as revenues for LinkedIn in year 10, and the entire, I don't even know what business to put them in. They're in the employment business, the networking business, but whatever the business is, I've essentially come up with a total market of $20 billion. We have a problem, right? You see what the problem is? I know you can be a great company, but no company's ever been able to hit 100% market share and keep going. That's the possibility test. We'll come back and talk about this. And one of the ways to check this out is go check the revenues. Don't check the income margins. All of that you can check later. Check the revenues in year 10. Huge effects of compounding over time. Now, if you look at growth rates for companies, you'll be able to go to Zacks and look up a growth rate. And in fact, in most Yahoo Finance too, you can get a growth rate for your company. Usually analysts forecasted growth. So I have a question about what that growth rate is in, what item it's in. And I'll give you the choice. Is it a growth rate in revenues, growth rate in operating income, growth rate in net income, growth rate in earnings per share? What are you saying? What's the big deal? Growth rate in one should be the same as the growth rate in everything else. What growth rate are you able to look up for your company on Yahoo Finance? I wish it were revenue. It is earnings per share growth. And it's the most dangerous growth rate to focus on. Why? Because as you move down the income statement, your growth rates are going to get bigger or smaller? They're going to get bigger because everything expands. Leverage kicks in, financial leverage, operating leverage. A 3% growth in revenues in good times translates into a 25% growth in earnings per share, especially if you add the steroid effect in the U.S. or what? It's per share. When we did the implied equity risk premiums, what did we see U.S. companies doing? Share buybacks, right? So when you see a 25% growth in earnings per share, it doesn't mean your top line is growing at 25%. Your top line might not be growing at all. So if you're doing a valuation of a company and you're forecasting growth in revenues and operating income, please don't use the analyst forecast of growth in earnings. It's not that you, in fact, today we're going to see that growth rate is pretty crappy to begin with. But even if it were the right growth rate, it's a growth rate in the wrong item. It's not the growth rate you and I should be looking when we look at evaluation. So if you don't believe me, go look up Yahoo Finance and say growth rate and earnings. It's really growth rate and earnings per share. And then start working backwards. Last question. We probably won't get to this, but one of the big deals we're going to make is about, you know, companies having to earn their growth. That you and I don't have the power to go around endowing companies with high growth just because we like them. So one of the tests we're going to run is how much are you reinvesting, how well are you reinvesting. So let's assume a company reports after-tax operating income of $75 million on revenues of $1 billion. So its return on capital is about, I'm sorry, it shouldn't be revenues, it should be invested capital of $1 billion. So return on capital is about 7.5%. So cross out the revenues, make it invested capital. Let's assume this company plans not to reinvest money. So its capital base is going to stay frozen at $750 million. And it's going to maintain its current return on capital. Just do the math. If you don't reinvest any money, your invested capital stays frozen. If your return on capital stays fixed, your operating income is going to also stay frozen. This company's growth rate is going to be 0%. You say, this is terrible. If I don't reinvest, I can't grow. I'll give you an escape hatch and we'll come to this. Is there a way this company can grow without reinvesting? What does it have to do to its return on capital? It's got to increase its return on capital. There is an efficiency growth we can talk about here. There are two ways you can grow, and we're going to talk about growth. One is to grow your capital base and make your company bigger. That's a reinvestment way. The second is to improve your efficiency in existing assets and get growth. The difference, though, is the first you can keep doing over time. You know, keep growing. The second is finite growth, right? You see why it's finite growth? Because you make yourself more efficient next year. Then you make yourself a little more efficient next year. At some point in time, you're going to hit a ceiling where you can't keep going. So if you tell me you're going to grow for the next 5 years with efficiency, I'm going to say, okay, that's what you think about your company. I'm okay with it. But if you say you can keep growing forever with efficiency, that argument does not hold up. So we'll come back and revisit this question as we go through. Okay? And that's basically the last point, is if I improve my return on capital from 7.5% to 10%, what's my growth rate going to be next year? Just work out the numbers. So this year I made $75 million, right? Next year I'm going to make $100 million. 75 to $100 million is a 33.33% growth rate. That's an incredible growth. And efficiency can deliver that, especially for low return on capital companies. So we're going to talk about both kinds of growth rates, efficiency, and how that matches up to what analysts are projecting, what historical growth is, because those are all numbers that are floating around when you start thinking about valuing a company. So let me go back to the lecture notes. Okay? We talked about operating income last week. We talked about making it updated, normalizing it, cleaning it up, correcting for accounting in, you know, inconsistency. So now let's say you have the operating income number in front of you for your company. You have to multiply that by 1 minus the tax rate. And we talked a little bit about this in the start of the class test last session, so let's come back and confront this. Here are your choices on tax rates. You could use the effective tax rate, which is accrual income divided by accrual taxes, accrual taxable income. I'm sorry, accrual taxes paid by accrual taxable income. You can compute your own tax rate by taking the taxes paid and divide by EBIT. That number is going to be lower than your effective tax rate because you're dividing by operating income. You can compute come up with a marginal tax rate for the country in which your company operates. So if it's a U.S. company, you can use 40%. If it's a multinational, maybe you'll use a weighted average marginal tax rate across the 10 countries it works in. Maybe the answer is none of the above. In which case, you better be willing to tell me what you'd use instead, because you can't say, well, none of the above, but I can't make up my mind. Or this would be great if it were the right answer, which is you can use any tax rate you want as long as you stay consistent, use that same tax rate all the way through. You know why that can't be the right answer? Because if that were true, in every discounted cash flow valuation, what's the easiest tax rate to work with? 0%. Take it out of the picture, right? If taxes really did not matter, we just say, why even bring taxes in? So unfortunately, you can cross out F. It's not a choice. You might not cross out E, but in which case, you have to tell me what your choice is. But really, it boils down to, do you want to use an effective tax rate or a marginal tax rate? And I laid the foundation for it last session when I gave you the average numbers. I said the marginal tax rate in the U.S. is 40%. The effective tax rate across money-making U.S. companies is about 28%. That's a gap, right? It's a pretty hefty gap. Why is there a gap between effective tax rates and marginal tax rates? And the U.S. has the largest gap across the world. It's won this contest hands down. Maybe Greece has a bigger gap, but that's a different reason. Right? It's a 12% gap. Why is there such a big gap between marginal and effective tax rates for U.S. companies? Yeah?
There are large number of deductions, say, for R&D expenses.
No, wait. How do I compute effective tax rates? I take taxes paid and divide by taxable income. So you can take all your deductions that you want. They've already been deducted to get to taxable income. So we're not even talking about the ornament effect from the Christmas tree, right, which is all those other stuff. It cannot be that you have a big depreciation, big R&D, because that's all been subtracted out. You come up with taxable income, but now you're paying only 20. Well, again, effective tax rate is computed by what? Taking taxes paid divided by accrual taxable income, which is after interest expenses. So it's not any of the normal culprits. Okay, let's go with that, because I think that is the core of the answer. A lot of U.S. companies make, in fact, last year 60% of the S&P 500 companies' revenues came from outside the U.S. They're U.S. companies with big chunks of foreign income. You're saying, so what? What did I say about the U.S. marginal tax rate? Highest in the world, 40%. The average marginal tax rate in the rest of the world is 28, 26, depending on the part of the world you look at. So when a U.S. company makes income in Europe, the tax rate that they pay on that income might be 27%. When it makes income in Asia, it might be only 25%. You think that's why the tax rate is low, because they make. But The U.S. tax code also has a very strange provision. It's one of six countries in the world that has this provision. It's called the global tax provision. Your tax on your worldwide income at the U.S. tax rate. Hang in there. There are six. You don't want to know the names of the other five countries. This is not the group you want to hang out with. Okay? Like Estonia is in there. Chad might be in there. So you're hanging out with Estonia and Chad. You're taxing worldwide income. But here's the catch. Let's say you make income outside the U.S. at 25%. U.S. tax rate is 40%. You have to pay the extra 15%, right? But you know when you have to pay it? When you bring the money. You would write stupid tax law. You get exactly what you deserve. So this is like saying, if you live on the border between between Massachusetts and New Hampshire, and your bank is in New Hampshire, you will not be taxed in Massachusetts until you bring the money over the border. What are you going to do? You're just going to leave it in New Hampshire saying, why the heck would I bring it? I'd still go spend it there. And that's essentially what U.S. companies have done. And hence is born the phenomenon of, what's that called? What's that cash called? Which is, it's called trapped. I remember the first time I read this term, trapped cash. Who the heck is trapping this cash? There's $2 trillion of trapped cash outside the U.S. Apple alone has $120 billion in trapped cash. It's trapped in the sense that if they bring the $120 billion back, they'll have to pay about $18 billion in additional taxes. You're saying, this is so immoral. Tax codes are not morality plays. It's stupid tax law. You say, what does the rest of the world do? The rest of the world operates in what's called a territorial tax system. Territorial tax system says, if you're a UK company, you make income in Hong Kong, you pay the Hong Kong taxes, you're done. You pay, make income in the UK, you have to pay the UK taxes. And other than these six countries that the U.S. hangs out with, the rest of the world is on a territorial tax system. You know, this worldwide taxing is not just for U.S. corporations. If you're a U.S. citizen who works anywhere in the world, okay, anywhere in the world, let's say you work in the Cayman Islands, you might pay no taxes, but the IRS is going to say, by the way, you're always 40% in taxes or 50% in taxes. Every year, guess what happens as a consequence? You're made to choose. Do you want to be an American and pay these extra, you know, $400,000, $300,000, or do you want to become Swiss? Why put people into that position, right? That's exact. So you have to, if you live in Switzerland, you work in Switzerland, you have to pay the Swiss tax rate. And then you got to file a second tax return, even though you haven't lived in the U.S. for 17 years. You worked in Switzerland for 17 years. Every year you have to file taxes to pay the extra tax.
Do they have
the
provision where you only tax when you bring your money back?
No, that doesn't work for individuals because, unfortunately, you can't say, my money's in a bank account in Switzerland. I've trapped it there. I wish you could. No? So that phenomenon is available only for companies, and this has created, of course, a very, very strange follow-through. So for Apple, what did I say? You have $120 billion in cash that's trapped, right? It's trapped in the sense you can't bring it back to the U.S. You cannot pay dividends. You can't buy back stock. You cannot make investments in the U.S. But you know what you can do with it? You can invest anywhere else in the world. This is perverse. You've legislated saying what? U.S. companies are not investing enough in the U.S. And then they're writing tax code that does what? Encourages them to invest anywhere but the U.S. Go invest in Outer Mongolia. Great. We can live with that, but don't. It's exactly what you're going to get. Do you know that when Microsoft bought Skype, it paid the entire $8.5 billion with trapped cash? You know where Skype is incorporated, right? It's a Luxembourg-based company. So Microsoft is able to do the acquisition with trapped cash. So basically you're encouraging me to spend my money anywhere in the world other than in the U.S. because of a really stupid tax code. And here's one final game you can play. Apple right now is a U.S. company. The $120 billion is trapped, right? But what makes Apple a U.S. company? Oh, it has its headquarters in one infinite loop or whatever that is in Silicon Valley. Okay. What if it moved its headquarters to Singapore? Hey, companies, as I said, are multinationals. They don't have to be attached to a country. If you can move your headquarters to a different country, overnight, what happens? The $120 billion cash that was trapped is now untrapped. From this day on, your income now gets taxed based on a territorial tax system. You think it's not that easy. You've probably heard of the phenomenon of inversions. There's a big controversial news stories over the Burger King and all these different companies trying. Inversion, basically what you do is you have a U.S. company, AbbVie, for instance, which is the Abbott Labs pharmaceutical arm, bought Shire Pharmaceuticals. I wanted to merge with Shire, which is a UK-based. And after a merger, you create a combined company, right? And you get to decide what to call that combined company and where to leave that combined company. And guess what AbbVie was planning to do? Buy Shire and move its headquarters to the UK. There's a fix. There's a simple fix. There are actually a couple of simple fixes. One is to bring the marginal, what's driving this in addition to a stupid tax law is the fact that you have this really high marginal tax rate, right? Because if your tax rate was 12%, Ireland, for instance, I think, has a global tax system, but who cares? Your tax rate is 12%. It's not like you're making, paying less in taxes anywhere else in the world. But if your tax rate is high and you have a global tax system, you're going to get trapped cash, you're going to get inversions, you're going to get exactly what you observe out there. And you can wring your hands and say, oh, this is terrible. But the fix is easy. Either go to a territorial tax system or lower your tax rate, so the problem goes away. You're saying, what about the $2 billion in trapped cash? It's like a bonanza for every presidential candidate now. Each of them has their own plan as to what they... So they're going to allow one time. This is a great thing about Congress. Every 10 years, the trapped cash gets untrapped with a one-time fix. It's a one-time fix. Like the one-time charges we talked about that show up once every 10 years. That actually adds to the game because if you know that every 10 years the trapped cash becomes untrapped, guess what you're going to do? You're going to untrap the cash and say, we'll never do that again. 10 years later, you'll be back doing the same thing. Expecting Congress to write rational tax law is almost impossible to do because tax laws, for some reason, have become instruments of social policy change. And when you do that, you're going to worry about all the political effects of doing this. But the reality is tax codes ultimately are revenue generators. And what we have in the U.S. is an incredibly inefficient revenue generator. We collect about the same effective tax rate that Germany does at 28%. But because we have a 40% marginal tax rate, what do we now encourage companies to do when it comes to debt versus equity? Remember, the cost of debt is based on your marginal tax rate, not your... So we actually have companies borrowing based on a marginal tax rate, paying effective tax rates similar to the rest of the world. We get the worst of all worlds. So enough on that rant on taxes, because let's get back to the question. Effective tax rate or marginal, I forgot the question already, right? Effective tax rate or marginal tax rate, we talked about why there's a difference for U.S. companies. Large portion of the difference is because they have foreign income. And a small portion of the difference is because they have tax deferral devices. Other than depreciation R&D, these are things you have clever tax lawyers who moved income into future periods. So you're sitting there valuing Apple. Effective tax rate right now is 16%. Do you see this is going to make a huge difference? Because as you go through time, if you leave the tax rate at 16%, you are making an assumption about tax codes changing, right? What's the assumption you're making? That there's going to be good sense, we're going to move to a territorial tax system, because each year you do this, there is this accumulated cash balance out there, which if Apple has to bring it back to the U.S., will cost them money. So that $200 billion in cash might not actually be worth $200 billion. Do you see why? Because the extra $18 billion in taxes you have to pay. So if you somewhere along during the course, I will send you my Apple valuation, and my last question on the spreadsheet asks, what do you want to do with the trapped cash? Do you? And basically, I'm asking, do you want to bring it back and pay the extra taxes, or are you going to leave it there? I don't know the answer to the question, because as you can see, this is a work in progress. Things are going to be changing as we do these valuations. But if you leave the tax rate at the effective tax rate, just remember the assumption you're making that the tax code is going to change to allow you to keep paying that effective tax rate. And if the lower tax rate is purely because of tax deferral that you have on tricks you played within the U.S., that'll catch up with you. Because eventually the tax rate will start to rise to reflect that deferred taxes. Okay? So what I try to do when I sit down to value companies, I start my valuation with the effective tax rate. Because that's what they're paying right now. So if I'm valuing Apple and they're paying 16%, I don't think they're going to jump to 40% next year. So they're going to pay 16%. But as I go through time, I try to move that tax rate towards what I think will be a marginal tax rate for the entire company. And that's, I think, a tricky question, because if I assume the U.S. tax code does not change, the marginal tax rate I should be moving Apple's taxes towards should be 40%, right? But if I assume that the marginal tax rate is going to come down, which I think it has to, there is no way it can stay at 40%. If you look at I think every single presidential candidate, the corporate tax rate they're suggesting is somewhere between 25 and 30%. Some are suggesting lower, but nobody's suggesting above 30. So in a sense, they're realizing that you can't have a tax rate very different from the rest of the world. So when you sit down to value Apple, you might say, look, I'm going to start with 16 and end with 30. Not 40, because that's not what the end game is going to look like. But you're allowed to change your tax rate over time. So you can have low tax rates up front because you think your company can get away with this low effective tax rate, but you have to start moving towards what you think is a more sustainable number by the time you get to year 5 or year 10, because now you're going to lock in that tax rate forever. Okay? Any questions on tax rates? Yes? It's basically taxes, accrual taxes paid, divided by accrual taxable income. So if you go to the Apple income statement, there'll be a taxes paid line item and a taxable income line item. So taxes paid. And in fact, they would report that as an effective tax rate in their financial statements. You go to Capital IQ, that's what's reported as the effective tax rate. So the tax rates you often will see for companies are almost always effective tax rates.
And then the marginal is just what your country
is. It's whatever you pay in your, not necessarily the country, what you pay on your last dollar of income. And that's why I'm saying it's open for debate about what that tax rate will look like as the tax code changes. Right now it's 40% because of the U.S. tax code being written the way it is. But that might change, and in fact will change over the 10 years, and you have to make your best judgment as to where it's going to end up. I'm actually moving increasingly towards using 30 to 35% as my end tax rate from the 40, because I think the 40 is unsustainable. But I might be too optimistic here because tax codes have been dysfunctional for a long time. They haven't been fixed yet. No. So let's do a follow-up. Let's assume that you have a net operating loss. You know how U.S. tax law works, right? Which is if you lose money as a company, you're allowed to carry that loss forward and claim it against income in future periods. So all too often when you see analysts value companies with the NOLs, net operating losses, what they will do is if you have, let's say, $1 billion in NOL, they'll take that NOL and multiply by your tax rate. So if your tax rate is 40%, they take NOL of $1 billion times 40%, say you're going to get a $400 million savings because of this NOL, and they will add it onto the value. Sounds reasonable, right? You have an NOL, it's going to reduce taxes, why not just take... But what are we missing when we do that? First, are you guaranteed the tax savings from the NOL? What do you need for the NOL to actually save you taxes? You need to make money. So that's the first thing you've got to check is, do I have the income? Because you can't just go to the IRS and say, can you mail me a check for $400 million? I have $1 billion NOL. You need income. So let's assume you have $500 million in expected income for the next 3 years. You have $1 billion NOL. How much are you going to save in taxes? Let's take year one. What's your saving in taxes going to be? You have a 40% tax rate. You'd normally have paid $200 million in taxes. You're going to pay nothing. Year two, $500 million in income. You'd have normally paid $200 million taxes. You'd pay nothing. Year three, your NOL is now gone, right? Because you lose half a bit. you're going to pay $200 million. So you got zero, zero, $200 million. So you save $200 million in taxes in year one and year two. What are we doing when we do this? First, we're reflecting the fact that the value of an NOL has a time value, which is you're not going to get the savings immediately. You've got to wait to get the income. Second, there's risk. What's the risk? To the degree that this taxable income, the income is uncertain, you have to discount the NOL, because if your income is uncertain, you might not get the tax benefits from the NOL. So when I show you my full valuations of money-losing companies, you'll actually see the NOLs built into my cash flows when I do my taxes. So when I do my cash flows, they will already reflect the tax benefits of NOLs. And I don't have to bring in an extra NOL line item, because I think that's a better way to deal with it than take the NOL and multiply by the tax rate, especially if you have a company that not only has an NOL, but is continuing to lose money. Which many startups, right? If you value Uber, it has an NOL already, and that NOL is going to get bigger before it gets smaller, because they're going to continue to lose money for the next 2, 3, maybe 4 years. And we've got to keep track of the NOL and claim that benefit. We'll come back and deal with that as we go through. Yes?
Is there an expiry for the NOL?
Is there an expiration for the NOL? It used to be 7 years forward, 3 years back. I think they've removed the 7 years forward. I might be wrong on this, because they discovered that if you don't claim your NOL within 7 years, you're probably never going to claim it at all. Okay? So I think that the NOLs can be carried forward. I'll check it out. I mean, it used to be that they, and it depends on the tax code too. Different countries might have different rules. Every country has some version of this rule where losses are carried forward. Okay? Any other questions? Let's talk about reinvestment. The first item that I want to think about in reinvestment is net capex, what I'm putting into my long-term assets. Okay? And here's what I want you to think about. Rather than think of it as two line items from an accounting statement, I want you to think about what you put into long-term assets to get growth. Connect the two numbers up. So if you want higher growth, you need to tell me how that higher growth is coming about. So if you're valuing Tesla, and you tell me they can sell 2 million cars in 10 years, you have a narrative going, right? That's fine. But those 2 million cars are not going to come out of their Fremont plant. The Fremont plant, I think, is a capacity of 250,000 cars. You see what your next obligation is? You have to tell me how much they're going to spend on those plants, where they're going to invest in these plants. That's got to show up in your cash flows. You can't count the 2 million cars and say, that's all great stuff, and not show me the reinvestment you need to sustain it. So depending on the company, there's always a follow-up question you need to ask when somebody says there's high growth at this company. So if it's a technology company, it might not be an assembly plant. It might be R&D. How much more are they going to spend in R&D? And that's part of the reason we made R&D into a CapEx, is to force that discussion out into the open. To grow, you need to reinvest. And the argument I gave last session is use as broad, a much broader definition of CapEx than what accountants are using. What accountants call CapEx is land, building, equipment, machinery, old-time CapEx. What we should think of as CapEx includes not just that, but R&D if you're a technology firm, recruiting and training expenses if you're an investment bank or a consulting firm, exploration costs if you're an oil company, very similar to R&D expenses being expensed right now. Think broadly. Okay? Or even advertising if you're a consumer product company, if you want to count that. But here's the other item you need to consider as part of your net CapEx. There are two ways you can grow fast. One is to take more projects, build more factories, grow faster. That's traditional CapEx. The other is to do what Cisco did in the 1990s. And Cisco actually is not the only company that's done it. How did Cisco grow from a $4 billion company in 1990 to a $400 billion company in 1999? They bought about 15 companies every year. The modus operandi was they would buy a young company, then a SWAT team. And I don't use these words, you know, I didn't make up these words. The Wall Street Journal described it as a SWAT team would come from Cisco into the young company. And what Cisco saw as its strength was to take technologies and make them commercial. They said, we're not very good at coming up with these technologies. So their big investment was acquisitions. And here's the problem. Accountants don't think of acquisitions as CapEx. Just think of them as something else. In fact, it's not just accountants. We all think of acquisitions as some other creature. We have a class on M&A. Why? just big capital budgeting. Why don't we just call it big capital budgeting and have all kinds of big projects? What's so special about acquisitions? They're just big projects. So if you're going to grow through acquisitions, and I want to show that growth in your top line and your bottom line, I have to count the acquisitions as part of my CapEx. It goes with what I said earlier. You want to count the good stuff, you've got to count the bad stuff. You think, what will happen if I ignore it? I'll give you an example. Between 1985 and 2005, GE's earnings grew about 8 to 9% a year. That was the Jack Welch miracle, right? He came into a mature company and he converted it from this company growing at 2% to 9%. We can debate how much of that was mirage, but he did manage to do that. But half the growth every year came from acquisitions. I remember seeing valuations of GE where this is what analysts would do. They take their revenues and earnings and grow them at 9% and use the argument, look, historically they've grown at 9%. What's the big deal? It's okay. Then they get to net capex and count only traditional net capex. You see what's going to happen? You've now counted a continuing growth from acquisitions, but you're not paying for the acquisitions. You're going to overvalue the company. You see, what choice do I have? I can't estimate what the acquisitions. We have two choices. Either act like there's no acquisitions and no growth from acquisitions, or put in the growth from acquisitions and make your best estimates of what those acquisitions are going to cost you. But then you have this escape hatch that analysts use. What if we pay with shares? You see where this is going? It's a cash flow. And if you're paying with shares, it's not a cash flow, says who? I've never understood this rationale. Because if you pay with shares, all you've done is skip a step, right? You see what I mean by skip a step? If you'd issued the shares to the market, raised the cash, and done the acquisition, I've treated it as a cash acquisition. Just because you used a barter system, I'm letting you evade my cash flows. And analysts let companies do this all the time. They do this with employee compensation as well, right? What do they add back? Stock-based compensation. Oh, it's not a cash flow, really? So I'm paying with shares, so it's not a cash flow. So if I issued the shares to the market and paid the employee the same amount or options, and it's ridiculous, but it's, you can see how this inflates cash flows and makes companies look more valuable than they should be. So if you're looking at CapEx, not only should you count cash acquisitions, you should also count stock-based acquisitions, share acquisitions. And those are actually tougher to get to. Cash acquisitions are going to show up in your statement of cash flows. Acquisitions paid for with shares will show up in the footnotes. So you've got to keep digging. You're not going to find it easily on the balance sheet, especially for a company the size of GE. You've got to look through the footnotes to see the company they acquired. And then what else do you have to find out? How many shares they paid to acquire the company. And then what else do you need to do to complete this process? The stock price on the day that you're saying, this is a pain in the neck. It's the reality. That's the way companies grow. You've got to count that in. And just to illustrate how much of a difference it made, I went to one of Cisco's last great year, 1990s, where it was Cisco's decade. 1999 was the peak of the pyramid. This was when Cisco was at its complete and absolute. For a brief period in 99, Cisco was the largest market cap company in the world. And if you looked in 99 at its financial statements, they did about 9 acquisitions. At that time, U.S. accounting allowed you 2 different ways of accounting for acquisitions. One was called pooling and the other was called purchase. I won't even torture you with the differences, but here was the big difference. If you did pooling, you didn't have to show goodwill on your balance sheet. If you did purchase accounting, you had to show goodwill. And if you showed goodwill, you had to amortize the goodwill over 40 years, which does what? It lowers your earnings. So guess what companies like to do? They like to pool. That, thank God, that law is now defunct. But in 99, the pooling basically means that, but to qualify for pooling, you had to pay with shares. So that was the other catch, is pooling was allowed only if you paid with shares. So in this case, if you look at the big acquisition, they use pooling, the small acquisition, they use cash. The collective cost of these acquisitions was about $2.516 billion. See, where's this going to show up? When I do my free cash flow for Cisco in 99, here's what it looked like. This is what the accountant told me the CapEx was, $584 million. That was what was on the statement of cash flows. Almost nothing, right? For a $400 billion company, $584 million. Their depreciation was $486 million. You net those out. The net capex, if I trust the accountants, would have been $98 million. I capitalized R&D like I did for... That adds another billion. So I've gone from $98 million to $1.1 billion. But when I add the acquisitions is when I get the oomph in my number. It goes to $3.7 billion. In 99, Cisco had a reinvestment rate of 110%. We'll come back and talk about what that is, but they actually reinvested more than their operating income back in the business. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? It depends on what they reinvest. And I haven't told you the other half of the equation. But the big reason my reinvestment rate is so high is because I've counted acquisitions as part of the net capex. So when you get a chance, go back and look at your company's financials, but then also look at the footnotes to make sure that they didn't do some acquisitions with shares, because if they did, you got to bring them into your analysis as part of your net capex. Working capital. We know what the accounting definition is, right? Current assets minus current liabilities. That's not the definition we should be using in valuation. I'm going to modify it a little bit. Working capital in valuation is the difference between non-cash current assets and non-debt current liabilities. Let me explain why. If you look at current liabilities, you usually see line items for short-term debt and short-term portion of long-term debt. You know what you should do? You should take those items, you should put them in with total debt, give the total debt a long-term cost of debt, and move on. So in other words, it has to go into debt in your cost of capital. It should not be part of working capital. So that's why I strip debt out of my current liabilities. So what's going to be left after I take out short-term debt and short-term portion of long-term debt? You're going to see accounts payable, supplier credit, deferred taxes, deferred this, deferred that, other accounts. So you're going to get all of that. So on the other side of the equation, let me talk about why I'm taking cash out of current assets. And we talked about this in the context in corporate finance as well. Inventory is a wasting asset. What do I mean when I say that? While it's sitting on the shelves, it can't make you money. That's why if you're a retailer, you look into the storeroom, it's filled to the roof, you should cringe. This is terrible. Accounts receivable is a wasting asset. You sell items on credit and you don't charge interest, it's a wasting asset. Is cash a wasting asset? You think it makes only 0.5%? You're right, it makes only, that's terrible, right? But where's the cash invested? In something liquid and close to riskless, right? What's the question you need to ask as a follow-up to see if it's a wasting asset? What did you and I make if we invested in something liquid and riskless? Check it out. Go on your brokerage account. Say, I'd like to invest in something liquid and riskless. You'll have to keep moving the decimal points to actually see a number. You're making 0.0003%. So it looks like cash is a wasting asset if you just look at the rate of return you earn. But if you ask the follow-up question, is this a fair rate of return? The answer is absolutely. This is what you should be earning on something liquid and riskless, which makes cash a zero net present value investment. And it should not be part of working capital. You see, what if it's operating cash? A lot of valuations make these assumptions about 2% of revenues is operating cash. I don't know where the 2% came from. It's kind of embedded in the rules. What's 2% of Walmart's revenues? $6 billion, right? You know when you can count cash as part of working capital? Not if it's operating cash, but if it's wasting cash. What's wasting cash? Currency, big stacks of currency sitting around the business. What kind of business would you be running? Maybe you're a drug dealer from Colombia. You ask me to value a business. You say, I'll do it. You know, what's your working capital? He shows you big stacks of currency. You count the currency. He says, that's part of your working capital. Okay, that's... First, you don't want to take that mission of valuing because you undervalue the business. I don't know what he'll do to you. Right? But I cannot imagine too many legitimate businesses which have big cash balances sitting around. You're saying, what about the cash in the till? The registers at all the Walmarts. This weekend, if you get a chance, hang out around a Walmart. Stay far away. Every 3 hours, you'll see a Brinks truck drive by. You know what they do? They clear out all the cash registers and put it into an account that actually earns a rate of return. It's true, Walmart has cash, but companies know this. They try to get that cash as quickly as they can, and increasingly as you use Apple Pay and car. I mean, we're also moving away from an economy where people pay with cash. That need for wasting cash has dropped off. And that's why when I value companies, I assume wasting cash is close to zero. That seems extreme, but you're talking about a $50 billion company. What if wasting cash is $50 million or $60 million? It's so small that I can afford to ignore it. So when I do working capital, it's non-cash current assets. It's going to be inventory, accounts receivable, other current assets, minus non-debt current liabilities. So you can take your balance sheet and work out what this version of non-cash working capital is. And here's what you could find. You could find that it's a very big number, in which case your company needs a lot of inventory or accounts receivable. And if it's a very big number, what does it do to your cash flows? If it's a big number that's getting bigger, it drains your cash flows because it's sucking up your cash flows. It could be a number close to zero, in which case it's kind of a neutral item. It doesn't affect your cash flows. That was the Walmart miracle, because until Walmart came along, the rule in working capital was you tried to keep current assets at twice current liabilities. I remember taking accounting, and my accounting professor saying, you need a current ratio of 2. Who makes up this stuff? Walmart said, why? Why should we have a current ratio of 2? That's silly. It's draining our cash. Why can't we have a current ratio of 1? They said, you can't do that. That breaks the accounting rules. So I don't care. It saves them about $4 billion in cash every year to break that accounting rule. If your working capital is zero, it's basically doing nothing. Could your working capital be negative? Yeah. And give me an intuitive explanation of a company. Sometimes it's negative and then goes back positive. It's temporary. But there are some businesses where working capital is consistently negative. What are these businesses doing? They're using supplier credit to grow, right? I remember the early days of Amazon. This was actually a way in which Amazon, they would sell books. And you'd pay right away, because they said, didn't say, you'd pay me in 3 months. You paid right away. But they had agreements with their publishers that they didn't have to pay for the books for 3 months. They almost got a free float. There's always a consequence, though, when you have this working capital game. So it's, you know, you say, why does everybody have negative working capital? There are consequences. It might actually increase your default risk. In fact, Amazon's stock price, I think, plummeted in 2000 for a little while because a story came out. Maybe Amazon won't make it. Look at their accounts payable. They're so big. The supply credit has become so large. But if you're willing to accept that risk, you can see why negative working capital can actually become a cash flow for you. So as you grow, working capital actually, it's like magic. But one of the things you're going to see about working capital is when you compute it, you know, year after year, it jumps around. The change in working capital in particular can be a big positive number, big negative, big positive, big negative, big negative. What I'm trying to say is if you compute the change in working capital from 2014, don't build your entire valuation off that change, because who knows whether that change is a reasonable number, a viable number. So what should you do when you see working capital? Look at it across time. Look at what's, so don't look at just the 2014 change, look at it across time. Look at it as a percentage of revenues. Why revenues? Because revenues is your top line. Might as well connect it to that. Look at it relative to the sector it's in. Because then you can see they're playing games with you. If you have a company which has a negative working capital in a sector where everybody else has positive working capital, you've got to stop and explain why they're able to get away with it. With Amazon, I'd have been able to do that. Why the rest of the retailing business had paused. Said, this is a young .com company. All these publishers want to sell their books through Amazon. They're willing to accept these deals. I get it. But if you cannot come up with a good reason, maybe you should replace that negative with that positive number going forward, because your estimates are for the future, not for the past. So as a general proposition, that's what I would watch out for working capital. Remember, it's a number that swings around, so look at averages across time. And remember, you can have a negative non-cash working capital. It's not the end of the world. It's a cash inflow. But the question you've got to ask yourself is, how long can I keep this model going? You see what I mean by this model going, where supplier credit keeps growing? Maybe your answer is, I can do this forever, in which case, go ahead. Or maybe it is until I get to a point where I get big enough where they will not let me do this anymore. So if a publisher is selling half his books on Amazon, he might not be as willing to say, take 3 months to pay me. So as a company scales up, maybe the non-cash working capital will have to go at least to zero, maybe not to a positive number, But those are all judgment calls you have to make. And for God's sake, do not break working capital down into its constituent parts. You know what I'm talking about? I don't want to see spreadsheets with accounts days receivable for the next 25 years. Come on. It makes you feel good to do all these spreadsheet line items, but they're completely meaningless because the reality is you're messing with inputs that we don't have information on. So don't break things down into 6, 8, 10 items. Just consolidate. When in doubt, use the aggregate, right, rather than the individual line items. So just to show you how these numbers play out, I took three companies, and this is from my first edition of the Dark Side Evaluation, which came out in 2000. At that time, the Dark Side Evaluation was really just about young dot-com companies or technology companies. So I valued Amazon, I valued Cisco, I valued Motorola, I valued Rediff. I know basically young companies because the argument is that people do strange things with these companies. And as part of the process, I did look at the working capital of each of these companies, and you can see what I told you about Amazon. And Amazon, in 99, had non-cash working capital of about minus $419 million, and revenues of $1.64 billion. Their non-cash working capital was -25.53% of revenues. Think of what that means. If I grow my revenues now, my working capital is going to get more negative. Gets more negative, I'm going to get a cash inflow. When I did my valuation, I looked at the industry average of 8.71%. I said, you know what? They're probably not going to go to the industry average. But I did assume that as Amazon grew, eventually they would have to start maintaining working capital. Why less than the typical brick-and-mortar store? Let's face it. A brick-and-mortar store has to maintain what I call show inventory. You know what show inventory is? You walk into a bookstore. There are just a few left now, I think. The Borders closed down. I think Shakespeare closed down. You walk in, and you'll notice that there are entire sections of the bookstore where nobody is hanging out. That philosophy section. What a waste of space. But if you're a bookstore, you're supposed to have all those books out there. Everybody's coming in. There's a big stack of Harry Potters right in the middle. Pick up a book. They leave. 80% of your sales are from there. But you have to keep the look of a bookstore. Somebody says, I want to read a deep philosophical book. You point them to that section. Go read. Nobody's been in that section for a couple of years. So watch for the cobwebs and the dust. It's there. Amazon does not have to maintain show inventory. So if nobody's ordering these philosophy books, they can say, you want a philosophy book? We'll get one written and sent to you. You're in no hurry. It's not going to change overnight. Philosophy is philosophy. So that's why if you look at items in Amazon's inventory, it reflects what people are buying. And they can afford, so their inventory needs are going to be smaller because they don't have the same needs that a brick and mortar store does. So in my steady state, I assume that their working capital will become 3% of revenues. And so what happens in my spreadsheet is initially I let them have negative working capital as a percent of revenues, but as I move through time, that number moves towards 3%. You're saying, why 3, why not 2? You want to use 2, go ahead and use 2. Won't make that much of a difference in the valuation. So, you know, if you want, we can talk about being less, but if you want to have a different number, that's okay as long as you can sustain it. With Cisco, the non-cash working capital was -3.3% of revenues. But the entire sector seemed to follow the same policy of negative working capital. This is a tougher challenge, right? Because it's unlike the other case where you said retailers have to maintain inventory. This seems to be a business where you don't need to have the same kind of working capital needs. So basically, I let their working capital be negative early on, but I moved it towards zero because as the company got larger, I felt uncomfortable leaving it at negative. I could have. There's no reason why it can't be negative forever, but I moved it to zero. For Motorola, non-cash working capital is 8.23% of revenues. The average over the last 3 years was 8.9%. The industry average is 7%. So here all the numbers pretty much are pointing in the same direction. I left it at 8.23%. Don't let the second decimal point kind of fool you. Basically, use roughly 8%. You're going to get the same value that I do. But essentially, three companies, three very different judgments about where I think they're going to end up. And it is going to affect your cash flows. So net capex, include everything you can. Acquisitions, R&D, exploration costs, non-cash working capital, be narrower than accountants are in defining that. It can create a big effect on evaluation. Question?
Yeah,
I made it up. And the reason I didn't spend too much time on it, the Amazon valuation, it affected my value in the second decimal point. So if I used 4 instead of 3, 2 instead of 3, it didn't make much of a difference. And in fact, I'll show you when I get to terminal value how I get around this entire problem by computing one reinvestment rate and not having to break it out into working capital and net capex. Now, we've talked about cash flow to the firm. We've got EBIT, we've got talked about tax rates, net capex change. At this point, you can compute free cash flow to the firm. But let's say you wanted to compute free cash flow to equity. Remember the way I describe free cash flow to equity is it's potential dividend. It's whatever's left over after you've met every conceivable need. You say, but why wouldn't companies just pay it out? For whatever reason, historically, companies have maintained actual dividends for the most part below potential dividends. There are companies out there that pay more than their potential dividends. Okay? But for the most part, companies. And there are a couple of reasons for that. One is dividends are sticky. Remember that's the word I used in corporate finance. What does that mean? That when you raise dividends, you're kind of stuck with those dividends. So companies are reluctant to raise dividends. You can already see why this will mean undershooting rather than overshooting. Because if you're at all worried about earnings, you're going to set dividends lower than they should be. The second is, if you hold on to cash, you control the cash as managers, right? And you can do acquisitions. It's a power trip. So the combination of those factors means that most companies don't pay out what they can afford to in dividends. So when you use a dividend discount model, you're in a sense understating the value of the company. Especially if you don't count buybacks. You are going to understate the value of most U.S. companies by looking at dividends. So then the question becomes, how do we measure potential dividends? And this isn't fancy. Potential dividend is what you can afford to pay out without hurting the company, right? It's what's left over after you met every conceivable need. Like what? You got to meet the net capital expenditures, working capital investments. You got to make debt payments, interest payments. And after you've written out all these checks, I'm going to look in the register to see what's left over. That's my potential dividend. That's what I'm going to call free cash flow to equity. But keep that in mind. What you're trying to estimate is the cash left over after every conceivable need has been met. The difference between free cash flow to equity and free cash flow to the firm is free cash flow to the firm is before debt payments. Free cash flow to equity is after debt payments. So let's see the setup for free cash flow to equity. Rather than start with after-tax operating income, I'm going to start with net income. You see why? It's equity. So basically, I want to go to an equity income. I'm going to subtract our net capex and change in working capital, just like I did when I did free cash flow to the firm. So the same rules apply. Count acquisitions, non-cash working capital. And then I'm going to look at the cash I get in from debt, which is any new loans I take is cash coming in. So think like the equity investor. Every time you borrow money, what happens to your bank account? It goes up to reflect the loan coming in. So it's a cash inflow. Every time you repay debt, it's a cash outflow. So last line item there is debt repaid, net of new debt issues. And the reason I net them out is companies, if they feel comfortable with their debt ratio, when old debt comes due, guess how they replace that with? They replace with new debt. So often if you're in steady state, that old debt and new debt tend to cancel out. In fact, there's a shortcut that you can use that some of you might remember from my corporate finance class. This shortcut works only if you're in steady state, where you're a mature company, you're okay with your debt ratio. You're saying 20%, that's my debt ratio now, that's what I wanted to keep it at. Your free cash flow equity can be computed as net income minus 1 minus the debt ratio. So let's say your debt ratio is 20%, 80% of your net capex minus 80% of your working capital needs. So you're thinking purely as an equity investor. You're saying, whatever I get from debt is not my problem. It's whatever's left over that I have to think about when I think about free cash flow equity. So free cash flow equity measures what's left over after every other need has been met. It's a potential dividend. You're saying, when would I use this formula as the opposed to? This is a very specific formula. The first formula I showed you, this one, the previous page, this is the more general one. This always works for every company. This one works only if you're willing to assume your debt ratio is stable over time. It requires fewer inputs. It's a little easier to use, but it does come with that cost. So let's try this. Right? I'm sorry. I took Disney in, I think, 1997. Net income was $1.533 billion. Their capex was $1.746 million, and their depreciation was $1,134 million. So the net capex was $612 million. The change in working capital, increase in working capital that year was $477 million. So let's say I wanted to compute the free cash or equity for this company. Using the shortcut, here's what I'd use. 1533 is my starting point. Their debt ratio is about 24%. So 76% of their net capex has to come from equity. And 76% of the change in working capital comes from equity. My free cash or equity would have been $704 million. They actually paid dividends of $345 million. Now do you see what I mean when I say you've used dividends, you're going to undervalue the company? If I valued Disney using a $345 million dividend base, I'm going to undervalue the company because they could have really paid $700 million. Now let's play a game that makes people really uncomfortable. We think of debt as a bad thing, right? Here I used a debt ratio of 24%. What if Disney used a 40% debt ratio? Or a 60% debt. What's going to happen to the free cash or equity? I'm talking about the new investments. They decide to use more debt. As my debt ratio goes up, what happens to my free cash or equity? It goes up. And intuitively, why is that happening? Because the more I borrow, the less I have to put in. This sounds like a free lunch, right? In fact, I computed the free cash or equity at different debt ratios, and my free cash or equity keeps climbing. Doesn't this then mean that every company should be... This is like a poster that LBO guys can use. This is why you need an LBO. Look, your free cash or equity goes up. What am I missing? The cost of equity. And what drives the cost of equity? Risk-free rate plus beta times risk premium, right? So what else is changing while my free cash or equity is changing? My beta is going up because I have a levered beta, my debt to it. In fact, here's the other shoe waiting to drop. My cost of equity is also climbing as my free cash or equity is climbing. See, this is very confusing. So my cash flow goes up and my cost of equity goes up. What's going to happen to the value of equity? I'm going to ask you that question to close off this process. So you have higher cash flows to equity, you have a higher cost of equity. Value of equity is the present value of your cash flows. So I'm going to read you four statements about leverage, and you tell me which one of these you would view as closest to what you believe about leverage. First, increasing leverage will increase value because the cash flow effects will always dominate the discount rate effects. Is that true? Why? Why is it not true? Who are you doing as your company? Glencore. That's it. I don't need to go any further. Right? There is a, so clearly that can't be true, because if it were true, Glencore wouldn't be, people would be celebrating the fact that there is an 80% debt ratio or a 70% debt ratio. So you can cross it out. Definitely not true. How about increasing leverage will decrease value because the risk effects always dominate the cash flow effects? If this were true, every company should be at a 0% debt ratio. And there are actually CFOs who buy into this. Less debt is more than... But clearly, it can't be true, because if there's a tax benefit to debt, clearly some debt belongs in your capital structure. What about this statement? Increasing leverage will not affect value because the risk effect will exactly be compensated by the cash flow effect. Well, there's actually a whole theorem and two Nobel Prizes that go with the statement. What's that statement? Corporate finance, what was it? What was the theorem that... It's Miller Modigliani 1. Miller Modigliani 1 says, in a world with no taxes and no default risk, your value as a firm is not affected by your leverage. So if you believe in Miller Modigliani, then changing your debt ratio will have exactly... Well, if you believe that you live in a world with no taxes and no default risk, then okay, that's fine. No, but I don't, so I don't feel comfortable going with C. Okay? Which leaves me almost by exception with D, which is... Increasing leverage can cut both ways depending on your company. If you're Glencore, if you ask me, will increasing debt ratios increase my value? I'm going to slap you around the face and say, get out of the way, right? Of course not. But if you're Google and you say, will increasing debt increase my value? Probably not to 80%, not to 50%, but at least to 10, 20%. It depends on your company. And that's the way it should be. Leverage should never, there should be no rules. Leverage is always good, leverage is always bad. Leverage is never always good or always bad. It's sometimes good, but done in moderation. And that's what we're trying to capture. So one way you can come up with the optimal debt ratio of your company, remember in corporate finance, we did it with the cost of capital being minimized. is you can actually look at the value of equity at different debt ratios and see at what value, at what debt ratio the value of your equity per share is maximized. And if you do this right, you should get roughly the same answer that you got from the cap, from the cost of capital approach as to what the debt ratio for your company should be. So that's all I wanted to say about earnings and cash flows. Let's talk about growth. I mean, the point I've kind of repeatedly made through this class that I'll make again is growth is not good, it's not bad, it's not neutral. It depends again on your company. So what we're going to do is devise a template where you can separate good growth from bad growth and be able to say, in this company, growth is destroying value. In this one, it's increasing value. So you sit down to value your company. You want a growth rate for your company. That's the first thing you look at. Before you get it by, you know, care about the future, what do you look at? You look at the past, right? You say, what did my company grow at last year, 2 years ago? It's natural. Don't not do it simply because it's past. It's called historical growth. It should be a no-brainer, right? So if each of us took the same company, let's say we all looked at Apple, and I gave you the task of estimating the growth over the last 5 years at Apple, or the historical growth rate in Apple, and we all came back next class, do you think we'd all come back with the same number? Let's think about what drives growth. So when we look at the past, I'm going to argue that what you come back with next class will depend on what measure you looked at. Was it EBITDA, EBIT, revenues, and net income or earnings per share? Different numbers. What period of time you looked at? 5 years, 3 years, 10 years, 12? You're going to get different numbers. It's also going to depend on how you computed the growth rate. You say, what do you mean? How do you compute the growth rate? You can compute the growth rate every year and average out the growth rates. That's an arithmetic average. Or you can look at the compounded growth rate, which is what did you have as earnings 10 years ago? What's the earnings now? And you, very different numbers. I'll wager that if we all came back with that, our growth rates would not match up. We'd have different numbers. So historical growth rate is not a fact, like many people claim it is. It is also an estimate based on the judgments you make. So we're going to start by looking at the past. The second, as I said, for many companies around the world now, you can get an estimated growth in earnings for the next 5 years. Or at least for the next year. Usually those estimates come from analysts following the company. Last year when I checked on Capital IQ, out of the 41,000 publicly traded companies, for 15,000 I was able to get a growth rate. And some people view this as a godsend. Why? It takes a huge load off your shoulders, right? You're valuing the company. Somebody else has already estimated the growth rate for you. Why would you waste your time trying to estimate growth rate when these analysts who spend all their time with these companies have already come up with a number? You're going to be tempted. And I'm going to try to untempt you by showing you how bad these estimates are. But it looks like a number that you should be building into your valuation. And as the third way to think about growth is to look at what the company is doing. And I'm going to try to push you there. But if you don't buy into it, you can go with historical growth or analyst estimates. So let's start with historical growth rates and why they can vary depending on how we do it. They can vary depending on the method we use to come up with the growth rate. Arithmetic averages or geometric averages. I've seen people actually use these log normal regression, strange things to kind of come up with growth rates. And they can all give you tweaks on those same numbers to come up with a different growth rate. It can be very sensitive to starting point and ending point. You know why growth rates for U.S. companies over the last 5 years look so good right now? No, let's even in regular earnings. What was 5 years ago? Just count back in years. So 2014, 2013, 2012, 2011, 2010, 2009. I know you guys don't remember 2009. 2009 was a really bad year for earnings. Do you see why this is going to make a difference? You choose a really low base year, your growth rates are going to get inflated. You add the buyback effect, they're going to get inflated even more. So very sensitive starting and ending points. So if I chosen 2007 as my starting point and used a 7-year growth rate, I might have a negative growth rate for the same company for which I got a positive growth rate. And thirdly, when you look at historical growth rates, a couple of things that can really cause headaches. One is what to do about negative earnings. Negative earnings becoming positive back negative throws off your growth rate calculation. You'll see why. And the second is the effect of companies growing in size. So you get a historical growth rate. You're getting a growth rate for your company over the last 10 years, but your company 10 years ago might have been a tiny company. So you've got to be very careful about projecting that growth rate. So let's talk about arithmetic versus geometric growth rates first. I took Motorola here from 94 through 99. And I looked at three measures of earnings, revenues, EBITDA, and EBIT. In fact, I had a fourth measure, net income and earnings per share as well. I couldn't fit them on the table. But yet, you know, five measures of how the company was doing. I computed an arithmetic average growth rate by just taking the 5 years' growth rates and dividing by five. And I also created a geometric average, which is you get it by taking the... For geometric averages, all you need is the ending earnings, 30,931, and the starting earnings. And you raise them to the power of one-fifth. Basically, you're getting the compounded average. And that number... So if I look at revenues, the arithmetic average growth rate was 7.08%. The geometric average was 6.82%. You see, big deal. They're pretty much the same number. You're right. Not much difference. When I look at EBITDA for same company, the arithmetic average is about 11%. The geometric average is about 5.4%. Now the difference is starting to widen, right? I get to EBIT. The arithmetic average is 42. The geometric average is 4%. My arithmetic average growth rate is now 10 times my geometric average growth rate. I have two questions. One is, what's causing the divergence between arithmetic and geometric averages? Why is the difference getting larger as I go across? I've kind of given you a clue in the table. What is driving that difference? The standard deviation. Now, if I make the standard deviation zero, what's going to happen to the arithmetic average and the geometric average? What's the standard deviation of zero mean? You have 8%, 8%, 8%, 8%, 8%, 5 years. Yeah, arithmetic average is going to be 8%. Your geometric average is also going to be 8%. The greater the noise, the greater the volatility in numbers, the bigger the divergence between arithmetic averages and geometric averages. So if I'd gone net income and earnings per share, guess what you're going to see? Even bigger divergences because the standard deviation gets even larger. You're saying, so what? I pick one number and stick with it? Which one do you think is more realistic? If I told you Motorola grew 42% a year for the last 5 years, or I told you Motorola grew 4%, that's a very different numbers, right? Which one do you think is closer to the truth? What was the starting earnings? Let's say EBIT was 2.6 billion. What's 42% of 20? Just grow 1 year at 42%. 1 year at 42% would give you another $1 billion. So your earnings should have gone up to 3.6 billion just in year one, right? Look at the ending number, 3.2 billion. Over the entire 5 year period, they grew only what, collectively, maybe 15%. It's part of the reason where mutual funds used to be allowed to report returns in arithmetic average, as arithmetic average numbers, until the SEC stepped in about 30 years ago and said, no, you can't do that. Because you can take a really crappy mutual fund, report a great-looking arithmetic average, when in fact you lost money over the period. Because all you need is one big positive year, and it kind of pushes into your averages. So arithmetic versus geometric averages, you can see why the divergence happens and why you have to be even more careful when you get to net income and per share numbers to use a geometric average. Second, let's talk about negative earnings. Let's take 1 year, Time Warner, from 96 to 97. In 1996, Time Warner had a net loss of 5 cents a share. In 97, it had a net profit of 20 cents per share. First, let me ask you, if I gave you those two numbers, was 97 a good year or a bad year? You went from minus 5 cents to plus 20. That's good, right? Now, let me ask you to compute a growth rate for 97. Just do the mechanical estimate of growth rate. How do we compute growth? We take the change, which in this case is 25 cents. What do we divide that change by? The base year, which is last year's number. So I divide 25 cents by minus, no, not zero. Last year I had minus 5 cents. So 25 cents divided by, I'm sorry, the change was 30 cents. Change was 30 cents, minus 5. So I divide the 30 cent change by minus 5, and my growth rate would be minus 600%. So what would I tell you in 97? I'll come and say, your growth rate this year was minus 600%. And he said, what? I went from losing money to making money. But mechanically, that's exactly what will happen as you go from negative to positive. So this, of course, has to be fixed. So what's the first fix? What's causing the problem? The denominator being negative, right? Is there a way you can fix that? Remember the math classes. Make it an absolute number. That makes the problem go away. Minus 600 now becomes plus 600. Say, now it makes sense. 600%, that still sounds like an incredibly large number, right? If that's really what's bothering you, instead of using in the denominator last year's earnings, you could use this year's earnings. In other words, you could take the change of 30 cents and divide by the 25 cents you had as earnings. That'll make your growth rate 120%. I'll cut to the chase. None of these growth rates are worth the paper they're written on. In what sense? You're not going to use any of these numbers as forecasted growth rates, I would hope, because they're all coming from this aberrant year where you went from negative to positive. You don't want to make forecasts based on this year anyway. So my suggestion is, if you're building an Excel spreadsheet, let's say, if you're doing it for one company, you'll catch it right away, but let's say you're building an Excel spreadsheet for 200 companies, you're computing growth rate from last year to this year, add an if statement. You know how to add an if statement, right, in Excel? If earnings per share last year is negative, growth rate is not available. Because that is the safest answer. Because any number you give will be a misleading number. It's only if both numbers are positive that you're going to compute a growth rate. It'll make your problem a much easier problem. So when you're negative earnings, there are lots of fixes. You can divide by this year's earnings. You can divide by the absolute number. They're all meaningless. Just let them all go. None of them is going to be particularly useful in forecasting future growth. Negative to positive. Yes?
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Does the geometric average suffer from similar problems?
It does. Because if your numerator is a positive number and your denominator becomes a negative number, you're going to have a problem, right? So any measure of growth rate, if you go from negative to positive, you know what the geometric average will not be affected by? Is if you have negative earnings in the middle of the series. So if you have positive, because all you need is the starting and the ending number. So you're not as affected by negative earnings, because as long as your starting and ending numbers are positive, the geometric growth rate will work fine. So it's less affected than an arithmetic average where each year's growth rate has to be computed. Okay. Last point I want to make about historical growth. You compute the historical growth for your company. You come up with this really high number. You get ready to use the number, just be a little careful. Now, I don't know whether any of you play golf, but in the 1990s, Callaway Golf rode the Big Bertha golf clubs from small company to large company. So this captures their glory years. This is from 1990 through 96. Their net income went from 1.8 million to 122.3 million. Arithmetic average, geometric average, whatever average you compute, great 5 years, right? In fact, the geometric average growth rate over that five-year period was 102% a year. You think this is good. You're sitting down to value Callaway Golf in 97. You decide to use 102% every year for the next 5 years. Let's see what's going to happen to the 122 million. You apply the 102% growth rate every year by 2000, what's got to be true? Every person in the U.S. will have to be carrying around a Big Bertha golf club. The fact that you don't play golf, it's maybe as weapons, maybe you'll find other uses, you know, beat each other up, whatever you decide to do. It's completely unreachable, but the reason this happens, again, is we take historic growth and feed it through. One of my biggest problems with modeling-based valuation is how much dependence we put on historical growth rates. I've seen modeling valuations where all the line items grow at historical numbers. Basically, everything gets 31%, 27%, 25%. That might work if you have a mature company, if you have a small company that's become a big company. Be very careful about making that approximation. One final point about historical growth. All of this is for what purpose? Because you want to value your company and you want a growth rate for the future, right? So I have a generic question. Is it useful to know what the growth rate in the past has been? How useful is it to know the growth rate in the past 5 years when you project out the growth rate for the next five? It's kind of a trick question, right? You say, well, how the hell do I know? About 50 years ago, there's a guy from Britain who came to do a PhD here. His name was IMD Little. I don't make up these names, that was his name, IMD Little. Little was his name, IMD were his initials. And he decided to do a thesis where in his thesis, here's what he did. He looked at, in those days, you had to collect data by hand. That kept your sample sizes low and your ambitions kind of constrained. So you took the earnings growth at companies in the U.S. from 1951 through 55, and the earnings growth at those same companies from 56 through 60. So basically, had growth rates in two contiguous five-year periods. And then he wanted to answer the question, how useful is it knowing what the growth rate was between 51 and 55 in forecasting the 56 or 60 growth? Statistically, what do you think he did? He computed the correlation between those two numbers. If you get a large positive correlation, what does it tell you? The last 5 years of growth is a good predictor of the next 5 years. If you get a large negative correlation, what does it tell you? If you get a high growth rate in the last 5 years, it's actually useful still. You have to use a low growth. What's the worst possible answer you can get if you're a believer in historical growth? He got zero. In fact, the title of his thesis was Higgledy Piggledy Growth. It's very British. Okay. Higgledy Piggledy, but it kind of gets the message across, right? Higgledy Piggledy Growth, what do you think? Like a kid's rhyme, you say, no. So that's what I want you to remember. When you get focused on historical growth, don't get carried away. Final slide and we'll end for the day. When we start off on Monday after the quiz, we're going to talk about analyst forecast of growth. If you get a chance, look up the analyst forecast of growth for your company and bring it with you to class. And that's one more thing I've added to your to-do list. Bring it with you to class because it'll allow you to get some perspective on what we're going to talk about on Monday.
Tell you that if all else remains the same,
but it again depends on